you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. Well, we are now 3 years into the presidency of Donald J. Trump, and if you think it's been a wild ride, you're right. And nobody documents that wild ride better than two Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters from the Washington Post, Phil Rucker and Carol Lenig. In their blockbuster new book, A Very Stable Genius, number one on the New York Times bestseller list, they take us back through every major event of the Trump administration so far. So wild, so unlike anything we've ever seen before, so frightening, it's a wonder we've even survived it. Well, what are the highlights and the lowlights? We sat down with Phil Rucker and Carol Lenig in their offices at the Washington Post. Carol and Phil, it's great to see you. Thanks for inviting us to come over to the Post.
Of course, Bill.
So, first of all, congratulations, number one on the New York Times bestseller list. That's BFD, as Joe Biden would say, right?
We're pretty thrilled.
I was impressed that you knocked Educated off the top of the list, and also Michelle Obama's book, Becoming. So that was a real score.
We've got a whole year to go to keep up with the First Lady.
That's right. A Very Stable Genius. Where'd the topic, the title come from, Carol?
Well, we were nearly done with the manuscript and the editing, and Phil and I had been asked to think hard and long about the title, and of course you always put off the hardest thing to the end. We both independently, as we were talking, started to talk about that word choice of his. And at first we felt that it might be a little edgy and that we had a little bit of worry about that, but we also realized the more and more we focused on our work that we wanted to use his words to stress test his own definition of himself, hold it up against a mirror, and hold it up to the people who knew him best. And we did more than 200 interviews. We interviewed more than 200 people who were close to him, senior advisors, former and current top-level officials in his administration, good friends. And not to a person, but in large measure, they did not find him to be a very stable genius and did not describe him that way.
But what does it say, Phil, to you that he describes himself or that anybody would describe themselves as a very stable genius, which he said in Quebec, right?
He has said it a number of times. The first time he used this phrase to describe himself came in January of 2018, about a year into the presidency. There was a national dialogue underway at that time about his mental acuity, his psychological health, his very fitness for the job. And he defended himself by saying, I'm not only a genius, but I'm a very stable genius. And he's, of course, used that term at least four additional times since then. You know, the people that we talked to for this book pointed out that anyone who's a stable genius would not call him or herself that. But it does speak to how, you know, Trump is so focused, and we show this in the reporting in the book, so focused on his self-image and what people think of him and establishing his supremacy. He thinks he's smarter than all of his intelligence briefers. He thinks he knows more about the military than the generals mm-hmm. do. He thinks he knows more about the economy than Gary Cohn did, and so on and so forth.
You know, so I don't take this the wrong way, but I loved your book. I loved the book.
How can we take that the wrong way?
I know. Well, because just before I read this book, I read a book called I Heard You Paint Houses, which is the book that The Irishman is based on. Mm. And I found them very similar in this sense, that The Irishman is just one mob hit after another. And your book is just one presidential outrage after another over the first 3 years. And the question I have is reminding myself of all the things that Trump has done and said, I find myself surprised that he's still there. He surprised you that he survived these 3 years that have been pretty wild.
It's one of the themes.
Or that we've survived.
And our institutions, right? It's one of the themes that Phil and I found ourselves sort of surprised by, but really understanding better as a result of archaeologically re-excavating these scenes that we reported in real time for the Washington Post. We dig deeper into them, and the theme that we come back away with is this is a president who increasingly drives the grown-ups out of the room, the people who wanted to give him good counsel and help a novice public servant, someone with no political experience, no governing experience. Those people, those guardrails are gone. And with each sort of chapter, the president increasingly views himself as a man who is the best at making these decisions. He doesn't need all these other people. And he's also increasingly emboldened. He beat, you know, a criminal investigation that found substantial evidence that would normally get another person thrown in jail, convicted and thrown in jail for obstruction of a criminal probe. He beat that. And with time, he became more emboldened. Literally the day after the sort of coda for the special counsel investigation, he picks up the phone and asks a foreign leader for a favor in a domestic political election for his own benefit. And he beat, you know, from, he would use these words himself, he beat the rap of the claims that he had behaved improperly or illegally in seeking Zelensky's help in investigating Joe Biden and his son. With the idea that past his prologue, he's just increasingly more and more unshackled and confident in his own decision-making, no matter how many norms it busts.
Right. So, I mean, think about that. As you point out, the Mueller investigation, as serious as it was and as serious as the findings were in the report, he just basically walks and then impeached. Yes, he has been impeached, but the Senate acquittal. And so, Phil, he must see looking forward that he's, in fact, able to do as president whatever he wants.
Yeah, you know, our reporting has shown that over these last 3 years, he's increasingly viewed himself as above the law and, you know, not subject to accountability the way a mortal being might be. He thinks as president he can do as he pleases, and he has faith that the Republicans in Congress and those that control the Senate are going to have his back no matter what it is that he does. And that's been proven not only in the Mueller investigation and through the impeachment proceedings, but think of all the other norms he's shattered or violations of what would traditionally be seen as the public trust that he has had and gotten away with, or the racist comments that he's made, or the misogynistic moments in his presidency where he's not really faced much consequence other than, you know, half of the country disapproving of his performance. And so going forward, I anticipate that mindset to continue and even grow because of the unwillingness of Republicans in the Senate to stand up to him, Mitt Romney being the exception, of course.
You interviewed, you mentioned, Carol, over 200 people. Is Donald Trump one of them?
Donald Trump, as we say in the beginning of the book, was interested in sitting down for an interview with us and actually told Phil in a pretty memorable moment for us that he viewed Phil as a very fair reporter. He wanted a serious book done, and he was looking forward to talking to Phil. Phil took the opportunity of a phone call back from the president to explain to him about our book, and that's where he made this offer. But as time went on and the war with the media, but especially with the Washington Post, escalated, President Trump withdrew from that offer and through aides declined and declined and declined to talk to us. And we're very disappointed and sad. We would have loved to hear his explanation rather than everyone else's around him for why he did what he did.
Have you got any phone calls since the book came out?
Not from the president. We've gotten a couple tweets from the president. He's not pleased with the book and has attacked me and Carol personally, but we've not spoken with him directly.
Right, which you might, I guess you expected that those—
It's exactly what you'd expect. but it's worth pointing out, Bill, that even though we didn't talk to the president for the story, we did everything we could in our journalistic power to fact check the scenes and the dialogue and the actions that are attributed to him in the book with multiple sources, with a review of diary entries, calendar entries, in one case of a video recording. We really tried to give him the benefit of the doubt and make sure that everything that we printed in this book was the truth as best we knew it.
Well, one thing that many things that struck me, one of them I wanted to ask you about is, and Carol, you alluded to this earlier, that from your reporting and when you put it all together here, it's stunning to me to see how many good people, people with a pretty good reputation in this town, went to work for Donald Trump and had their careers destroyed and are no longer there. I mean, I did a little list just off the top of my head, and I'm sure there's some here that I'll miss, but Sean, in no particular order, Sean Spicer, Reince Priebus, Anthony Scaramucci, Steve Bannon, Don McGahn, Michael Flynn, John Kelly, James Mattis, Rex Tillerson, Kirstjen Nielsen, Jeff Sessions, Gary Cohn, H.R. McMaster, John Bolton. Who's left? I mean, who, about the people around him, what does this say?
You know, sometimes there have been moments where, and it felt like it was an episode of The Apprentice, you're fired, you know, almost like it was exciting to end each show with you're fired. What we found was that a lot of the people who tried to explain to the president, this is illegal, or this is worrisome, or this is not the way the U.S. government works, those people got a pink slip or a tweet in the middle of the night. And increasingly, the people around the president view their mission as telling him yes. Just as a comparison, we are told by multiple people that John Kelly often took the president privately aside and said, Mr. President, you had this idea today. That is not going to work. We are not going to do that. There's a scene in the book where John Kelly tells the president, if you want to give your son-in-law a clearance over the objections of the career public servants who know how to do this, you're going to have to do it yourself. I'm not doing it. So you see what happened to John Kelly. Now, fast forward to our current scenario that is at the center of the impeachment investigation and ultimately the House's impeachment of President Trump. Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney was willing and comfortable agreeing to block the aid to Ukraine that Ukraine was relying upon to save its soldiers in a battle with Russia, was willing to withhold it, even though his office and his lawyers were getting warnings from the Government Accountability Office that withholding that aid was illegal. But that's what Donald Trump wanted, and that's what Mick Mulvaney gave him.
Right. But the one thing that Donald Trump demands, what we've told more than anything else of people around him, is loyalty. Loyalty. It sounds like it's a one-way street.
It is, and it has been for years now. You know, the guiding principle of this administration is loyalty, as you point out, but it's not loyalty to the country, which is what we've seen in past administrations. It's loyalty to Trump, the man, Trump, the brand, Trump, the president. And, you know, he has zero tolerance for any kind of personal or political betrayal. And once somebody betrays him, and it's in his estimation, you know, what that betrayal might be. For example, Steve Bannon appearing on the cover of Time magazine was an act of betrayal to President Trump. So, you know, Trump will internalize that and turn against people and shuts them out and pushes them out of the government. There's no tolerance for that. But he doesn't provide the same loyalty back. So there are people who've served him for years and acted loyally to him and do not get the same kind of personal loyalty in return from the president.
Is there anybody, did you find anybody around him today who's willing to say, Mr. President, you're wrong, like John Kelly did? I think some others that you mentioned did. Gary Cohn, you cannot do this. Or even, I think, at one point, Jeff Sessions said, no,
yes,
we can't do that.
I mean, you think about all the people who said no, and they are gone. In our reporting, you know, that happened to Kirstjen Nielsen. It happened to Jeff Sessions. What were their crimes? They tried to remind him that the things he was proposing to do were illegal or unethical in the case of Jeff Sessions. But, you know, in terms of today, there are surely instances where people are trying to talk the president out of some of his more impulsive, rash decisions. I know for a fact that the president very much wanted to get rid of some of these National Security Council staff, but he was encouraged not to do it until after the acquittal or the Senate trial, whichever came first, after the Senate trial was completed. And indeed, minutes after his acquittal, that is the first thing he did.
I understand how people could be treated that way who work for the president in the White House. I had heard about this before, but until I read your reporting, I must admit I was shocked by the meeting at the Pentagon you talk about, where he went with James Mattis was there, of course, mm-hmm. and Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and unloaded on the generals. Phil, tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was a harrowing moment in the first year of the presidency, July of 2017, about 6 months in. And the Defense Secretary, the Secretary of State, Gary Cohn, the economic advisor, all were concerned with Trump's lack of knowledge about the world and lack of understanding about our alliances and military deployments. So they arranged a tutorial in a room at the Pentagon called the Tank. It's really a sacred sanctum space, the conference room for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where decisions of war and peace are made. They get the president there. They start doing a tutorial, a slideshow to show him where we have troops around the world, why we're a part of NATO, you know, underscoring the importance of different alliances and deployments. And Trump was impatient. He didn't like being lectured to or schooled in that environment. And he started bellowing.
Because he knew it all.
He thought he knew it all. So he started barking and bellowing at the generals and at the other civilians who were around the table. He said the war in Afghanistan was a loser war. He said that the generals were a bunch of dopes and babies. And the thing that really got people going was he said, "I wouldn't go to war with you people." Those are the president's words. Nobody stood up to him except for Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State. And after that meeting concluded, Tillerson was overheard in a hallway telling some of his colleagues that the president was an effing moron. It was the end of their relationship. But even worse was the fact that this is the commander-in-chief disrespecting the high brass of the military, not really showing a patience for understanding his responsibilities as president. And these are the very people that he would have to rely upon to lead the United States into war in the future.
It is stunning that none of the generals fought back or challenged him. Did you find that?
Well, you know, Phil describes it so well.
Although he's the commander-in-chief, maybe I'm misreading the military code, if you will.
There were people in the room who talked to Phil and to me who said that the thing that was so chilling was the silence, but not just from the flag officers and generals. Mike Pence said nothing. He was a sort of a wax figure, as described by some people. A woman appeared to be crying and bending her head forward to sort of conceal what was happening in her eyes. And Rex Tillerson, as told to us by witnesses there, was looking at Mattis like his eyes boring into Mattis's head. They're very close friends, but Mattis wasn't saying anything. He had his head bowed as well. And finally, Tillerson just said, "Well, I guess in his head, he's thinking, I guess these officers can't buck their commander in chief. I'm going to have to say something." And he was, you know, what he stood up and said, he said again in another meeting in December, when the president was also lambasting the officers in the Situation Room, talking about how they needed to make money on these troops and start charging foreign governments for the bases that we have there that ultimately keep us safe, but Donald Trump wanted other countries to pay for the safety they provided those regions. And Tillerson stood up with his back this time to the president and said, "You know, I didn't put on a uniform, but I know people who did, his father, his uncle, his great uncle, and they don't put it on to make a buck. They do it to protect our freedom." And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dunford, called Tillerson later that night after that meeting and said, "Thank you for taking the body blows for us. I'll never forget it."
Carol, Phil, hold on just a second so we can take a quick break, and then we'll resume our conversation about a very stable genius. Today's podcast with Phil Rucker and Carol Lending, brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers. Yes, the good men and women of the AFT under President Randy Weingarten, a real powerhouse in the American labor movement. Founded in 1916, the AFT today represents 1.7 million members in over 3,000 locals nationwide. Teachers of America from K through 12 through 12th grade and higher education as well. We salute our nation's teachers, thank them for the difference they make in our classrooms every day, and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back here at the Washington Post with Phil Rucker and Carol Lennig, authors of A Very Stable Genius, Donald Trump's Testing of America, number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Another thing in your reporting that struck me, not only all the people that have come and gone, is one thing we were told about Donald Trump, and he touted when he was running for president, is he was the deal maker. He was the ultimate best deal maker. Again, in my notes, I'm sure I forgot a couple, but I just noted North Korea, a new Paris Agreement, a new Iran Agreement, a new Affordable Care Act, this prisoner exchange between President Erdogan, and all of these are deals that, as you report, fell apart. They never happened.
Exactly.
I mean, did he ever really make a deal?
You know, the one deal that he would claim credit for that was just recently passed was the new NAFTA, the USMCA, the trade deal with Mexico and Canada. Of course, critics of the president are quick to point out that it's not all that different from the original NAFTA.
From the old NAFTA,
it just
right?
has different branding. But look, this is a president who talks a big game about his ability to make deals and negotiate and leverage what he sees as his personal charisma and sort of one-on-one charm to extract benefits from mm-hmm. foreign countries and has most often not delivered. Either he's been stymied by other forces or he's completely miscalculated his counterparts. In the case of North Korea, he thought he could get across the room from Kim Jong-un and somehow convince North Korea to abandon its nuclear program, which it has spent decades developing. And of course, that was not to be the case. And Kim Jong-un seems to have gotten the better hand so far out of the president. They're continuing to build nuclear weaponry in North Korea and show no signs of backing down.
Right. And a kind of an extension of that, I guess, is the failure to make the deals. Particularly North Korea, maybe, is the one that we think of most of all, is that, at least in the case of North Korea and in the case of Vladimir Putin, the president actually said, I believe them. I believe what they say over our people, right? With Putin, he said they didn't interfere in the 2016 election. I believe him. Kim Jong-un said, I knew nothing about outer warm beer. Hard to believe. But that's what he said, so I believe him. What is this affinity for autocrats? I mean, this almost adoration of autocrats.
You know, President Trump is now on his fourth national security advisor, but his second national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, confided to many people that we interviewed that he could not make heads or tails of why the president seemed to want so badly to get in good with Vladimir Putin. It actually bothered HR, who has studied that region of the world very closely, And he kept saying, I just don't know why he wants this bromance, but he does. And it is interesting that the allies who have served us so well and have been there for us through thick and thin, including in politically really difficult and stressful military battles, they're people he discards as weak mm-hmm. because they are genteel or perhaps diplomatic in the way they say things. But the autocrats he seems to really want to cozy up with. There was one person who told us that when the president hears Erdogan's voice on the phone, he seems to be very, very happy and admiring, almost as if Erdogan has this sort of deep Hitlerian voice. The deal he forgive me, can I say one thing about Putin? That moment in Helsinki is actually one of the rare moments when the president has to sort of eat his own words. It's one of the times he actually faced consequences, because that moment was so galling to Republicans, him saying he believed Putin over the intelligence agencies, that, you know, Putin left that Trump left that meeting feeling victorious and as if the press conference had been brilliant, got on Air Force One to fly home, thought he looked so strong to the world and the master deal maker. But then on Air Force One, his staff start to quietly come to him and explain the internet is blowing up with comments from all sorts of leading Republicans saying this is unacceptable, this is not presidential, this is dangerous. And these Republicans are so senior, not just John McCain, many others, that the president then has to eat his words and say that he misspoke, even though he obviously did not.
Right. Another thing, and here we are at the Washington Post, where Glenn Kessler keeps track of the presidential misstatements, or shall we call them lies. I don't know what the latest number is. I think it's over 16,000.
That's right.
And yet, Phil, Carol, he gets away with it. And does he even know that he's lying at this point? What did people tell you?
You know, you're right that it's an extraordinary number of lies, misstatements, falsehoods, exaggerations.
I'm growing up, right, a little older than you are, I remember growing up thinking the president of the United States never tells a lie. And, like, it was a big deal when Dwight Eisenhower was caught saying a U-2 plane did not fly over Europe, right? I mean,
yeah.
And that was a big 16,000 compared to one.
George Washington and the cherry tree.
There you go. I'm sorry, Phil.
Yeah. Well, it's a different time. And, you know, this is a president who in a way sort of lives in a fantasy sometimes. He believes his own reality. He makes up his own facts. He lies with abandon, and he doesn't really care what the fact checkers have to say. And the reason that he does it so much and can get away with it so much is because his supporters don't care either. Tens of millions of people around the country could care less whether he has one Pinocchio or four Pinocchios by the Washington Post fact checker. They believe in him. They believe in the intensity with which he communicates and claims to be fighting on their behalf, and without any consequences from the voters or from the people in his own party, Trump continues to do this. And the fact checker count, by the way, is so high, but the other thing to keep in mind is it's been increasing at a greater pace the third year of the presidency. So he is lying more frequently now than he did in the first 2 years.
I at one point double-checked, because I read a sentence in the book that did not have quotes around it. So it's the two of you speaking about the midterm elections. Actually, it's on page 311. And you say that the Trump's behavior coming into the midterms of 2018 amplified his ugliest characteristics as president. What did you mean by that, and what does that say that we could expect in 2020?
Some of the president's ugliest characteristics are the ones that make parents concerned about how they're going to, set up role models for those children. You know, the ugliest characteristics of any person, it's not just of the president, telling the truth straight out without hype, without hyperbole. Those are wonderful characteristics. Being gentle and kind with your adversaries and disagreeing with them without vilifying them. Also, treating our military as an actual group of patriots that serve us and protect us, again, allow us to sleep at night safely instead of a political prop. And in those three ways, the president entered that election cycle definitely as an ugly person that a lot of parents probably wouldn't want their children to emulate.
And I guess we could expect just more with the Mueller thing and the acquittal behind him coming into 2020.
Yeah, and, you know, at the end of the midterms in 2018 specifically, what we were getting at there was Trump was out on the campaign trail playing to the most sort of racist and xenophobic among his followers. There was a lot of language he used around illegal immigration and about black people. And really, even with some of the advertising that his campaign put out in on digital platforms, created a very corrosive tone to the final hours of the campaign. And we should expect that again this time. It's the way he closed out the 2016 campaign. It's the way he helped Republicans keep the Senate in 2018. It's probably going to be his strategy to seek re-election.
In your reporting about the workings of the White House, how important is the role of Jared and Ivanka? Are they, it appears that they're into everything and maybe the two most powerful people in the White House. Is that an overstatement? They weave in and out of your book.
I think it might be too strong a statement to say they're among the, that they're the most powerful people in the administration, but they certainly are powerhouses for sure. And especially in the first year and a half, first 2 years of this presidency, they had the carte blanche to walk in and out of whatever meeting they wanted to the great annoyances of the chiefs of staff, whichever one was in charge at the time. They also posed a real problem for the legal team that was representing the president during the Mueller investigation, because they would sort of learn little bits of information about in all of these far-flung meetings that they were attending. And they would also then share that with other people that were witnesses or appeared to share that. So that had the impression of potentially tainting the witnesses, if you will. Mm-hmm. There was another great concern, which is that neither of them had a lot of experience in the areas in which they were deciding to hold court, especially Jared. And, you know, most recently, Jared's been ridiculed to some degree for saying that he brings a freshness to the topics such as Middle East peace, because he's not entrenched in all of the old experiences of everyone going back, you know, to the days of George Mitchell and Bill Clinton. Instead, he's read a lot of books, and he says that where some people see problems, he sees solutions. People think that is incredibly naive, including some of the people at the negotiating table with him. That's been a problem. At the very beginning of this presidency, several senior aides warned the president, don't let these people come in because they're your loved ones, they're your family members, and no one's going to be able to tell them what to do because they'll be too afraid to do it to a member of your family.
Well, and that's true, isn't it? They are the survivors because they're family. They'll be there as long as Trump is there.
That's right. And the biggest miscalculation that some others in the administration made was to try to get crosswise with Jared and Ivanka and to try to cut them out or hurt them internally, because Trump is always going to prioritize family and blood over anybody else.
So just one final question. When having written this book, and again, extraordinary work, congratulations again. When you look at what others have done writing about the Trump administration or on television or radio talking about the Trump administration, do you think the media has covered the Trump administration fairly or negatively or given him too much of a break? Overall, what's your take on how the media has covered the Trump administration?
I would like to hear what Phil thinks, too. My impression is that
we know what Donald Trump, I'm sorry, thinks about the coverage, right?
So. Yeah. But he's addicted to our coverage. You know, he says he canceled his subscription, but we see him holding up our paper. And he tweets at us about stories we've written, calling Phil a nasty lightweight and me a lowlife after he allegedly, again, canceled our subscriptions for stories he didn't like before. But to your question, Donald Trump is a genius in his mastery of his megaphone. He is a master in marketing himself. And He has had a bright, shiny ball. He's been waving in all of our faces every morning, whether it's his tweet or his comments in the driveway. He has kept us all focused to a large extent on what he has to say, the message he has for the day. Every White House reporter has to cover what the president says, but sometimes that media savvy that he has keeps too many of us distracted from what's really going on in his administration. And I think the news media has done an amazing job, but we've had to contend with that additional element of the shiny ball.
There are every day, Phil, aren't there, things that are happening in the administration, whether it's at HUD or at Interior or State or wherever. Take the expansion of the travel ban,
mm-hmm, if you will, mm-hmm,
that don't get the coverage that they normally would because we're all focused on Trump's latest tweet.
That's right, although I think a number of organizations have really risen to the occasion the last few years. And, in an unbiased way, I would suggest the Washington Post is among them, just in terms of staffing up and having the resources to not only cover the dramas and the crises of the moment inside the West Wing, but to really hold all of public officials and all of the administration accountable and tracing what they're trying to do in the darkness without people knowing and bringing a lot of that to light. That's been essential, especially these last 3 years, and I think that'll continue throughout the presidency.
Well, one of the best things that Marty Baron has done is give the two of you time to write a very stable genius in the middle of all of the rest of the work that you're doing.
Thanks, Bill. We'll share this
Donald J. Trump's testing of America. We're still being tested. Phil Parker, Carol Lenning, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank
Congratulations
you, Bill.
Again.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of the Bill Press Pod. A big thank you to Phil Rucker and Carol Lenning. And thanks to all of you for joining us. It's so good to have you on board. And remember, three quick little items if you haven't already done so. Please subscribe to the Bill Press Pod by going to wherever you're listening to this podcast. Find the Bill Press Pod, click on subscribe, and you are in. While you're there, give us a good rating, maybe a 5-star rating to make us feel real good. And please, for your sake and ours, follow me on Twitter at Bill Press Pod, at Bill Press Pod. You'll hear from me probably a couple of times a day, and you'll get advance notice of every new podcast on the Bill Press Pod. So hang in there, stay strong, and we'll see you on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.